Hello, I'm Wayne Burkle, Lung Cancer Program Director for Cancer Care, a national not-for-profit organization offering support to cancer patients and those who care for them since 1944. Through a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and Medscape, I'm pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Jimmy Holland, a pioneer in the field of psycho-oncology, noted author, and the Wayne E. Chapman Chair in Psychiatric Oncology at Memorial Sloan Cancer Center in New York. Welcome, Jimmy. I'm glad we could get together today and talk a little bit about your experience in psycho-oncology.
Just delighted to be here.
Back in 1977, you came to New York, and you initiated the first cancer hospital that had their own psychiatric unit.
Right.
And I imagine that was quite groundbreaking, and I imagine that there were a lot of controversy and attitudes about that Wow. going on. So how did that go about for you?
It was truly new, despite the fact that cancer is such a frightening disease. You would have thought concern about people's emotions would have been a part of the development of the field, mm-hmm. but not true at all. I think that oncologists, as they evolved, were so intent on trying to treat people and trying to cure it that they just didn't have the time to think about how difficult it was for patients. And also, there was a stigma against talking to patients about their diagnosis. There was a time when we did not give patients their diagnosis. They did not know what it was. The philosophy was, if we tell them they have cancer, they'll give up hope. So therefore, we won't tell them. And the family would be told, but not the patient. That occurred for a long, long while. It changed in the 1970s when a few public figures came out. Betty Ford and Happy Rockefeller were big figures in the 70s, about mid-70s, who said, yes, we had cancer. And that was they were the first real figures who talked about it. And the other piece of it was we saw patients being cured. And we saw testicular cancer, lymphoma, leukemia in children, and this was a hopeful sign. So some people began to say, yes, I had cancer. Because before that, you didn't want to tell anybody you had cancer because you'd lose your job. You'd be like a leper. You might give your cancer to somebody. There was a lot of fear of contagion.
I remember in your book, The Human Side of Cancer, you told early on in the book the story about the taxi driver,
right?
And saying that he didn't want to take you to where the big C was.
Big
or something
C. It was
like that.
The big C.
So, mm-hmm. how? I mean, that was 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. Where are we now with that?
Well, I think the stigma on cancer has diminished enormously. I think people were ignorant about the disease. Today, it's written about, it's talked about, it's almost in your face in the mm-hmm. newspaper nine-tenths of the time, more than you even want to read about it. But I think it becomes so commonplace that people are not so frightened of it. And they know that if you get cancer, yes, you could die, but you might also be cured. And so I think that optimism has diminished the fears, and we have a lot of good treatments, and we have some sites of cancer that are really highly curable today. It's a different environment in which one has cancer, and look at the range of support services available. I mean, some people want dance therapy, some people want talk therapy with somebody like me, some people want cancer care like you.
Right.
But there's a whole range of things people can choose from to get support, and it's okay that they help themselves. I think a long time ago we also thought you just passively went along with it, and the doctor would say, there's nothing you can do, just you have to count on my treatment. And now people want to say, I want to know about diet, I want to know about exercise, what can I be doing?
Right. So it sounds like you're really describing a partnership between the oncologist or the cancer physician and the patients. So what should they be bringing to that partnership?
What should the patient bring? I think that's a very good way of describing how both the patient and the oncologist see it today. It did not used to be that way. Mm-hmm. It was paternalistic in the old days. I'll tell you what to do. And, you know, it's your job just to comply. I think today the patient's seen as a partner in the team, and they make decisions together. The patient hears what are the options, and they have a chance to say, I understand, this is what I want to do. So it's a very much more eclectic, even kind of interaction. And there's a whole team with the oncologist The social worker, besides a nurse, there's a nutritionist. There can be a, just depending on the size of the place, there can be a whole range of professionals there to help.
Right. Yet at the same time, I often hear people talking about doctors and the oncologists, and they say, well, you know, in the olden days, whatever that is, okay, you had sort of the country doctor that really did pay attention to the psychosocial issues that patients had, and there's a sense now that they're too busy, they're not checking on that, and so sometimes the doctors are response is, well, there's not enough time, and yet my sense is that you feel it's very important that the doctor is very involved in knowing how well their patients are coping.
Absolutely. I think if you go back to the old horse and buggy days and the black bag that he carried around, there wasn't much in that black bag. And about all this poor doc had to offer was good support and tender, loving care and holding the hand and so on. And so I think the more the black bag filled up and the more tests that we now give, this has distanced the doctor and the patient in all of medicine. One of the things that's 40 years later I've learned is that our emotions are exactly the same. They haven't changed one iota over the millennia. It's fear, it's worry, it's what's going to happen to me, what's going to happen to my family. Exactly. All of those fears are all there. And I think what the patient has always wanted and still wants is to say, just to know, this doctor cares about me. He really cares about what happens to me and giving me my right treatment. And when you feel like your doctor cares about you, then you're right there, ready to help. But I think too often today, this distance, it loses some of that sense that somebody, you care about me. I think we all want to be cared about. You know, that's a pretty human basic emotion. But when you feel vulnerable, when you feel frightened, when you feel like, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, I could die of this, then you really want to have someone that you can call on, depend on. He's going to be there with you. And that's what I think doesn't take enormous amount of time to do that. So I think we hide behind time a little too much. You can convey that in a pretty short interview. Look, I'm here for you, buddy. We're going to do this. If this doesn't work, we'll do that. But you know I'm here for you. And I preach that to our young doctors.
Right. So how can doctors find a little bit more time to kind of hear their patients? Are there things that they could be doing?
It's an economic world that we're in, and in which medicine has become a business. I think the time crunch is terrible, and I think doctors have to take the line that, you know, I can't take care of this person if I cannot spend enough time to at least know what is the treatment they want, how are they doing, how are they coping. The team helps. I think there are members of the team that can take some of that burden, but that initial sense of interaction between two people is a critical part of it.
Right. So I can't pass up the opportunity to tell you how wonderful the human side of cancer is.
And
I've used it as a tool with my clients over the years. And one of the you devote a whole chapter in Human Side of Cancer to the tyranny of positive thinking. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
I'd love to talk a little bit about that, because I think that, you know, it's bad enough to have cancer, but when all your family and your friends say, well, you've got to be positive, you've got to fight this thing. And, you know, and they're exhausted, they're beaten up on by the treatments. And it seemed to me that adding that burden to have to be positive was just ridiculous. We have no evidence that says being positive cures cancer. It's not so. Yeah, of course it's better to have a good attitude. You can get your treatment better, you can participate better. But I call it the tyranny of positive thinking, because I think it's a burden for patients when they feel that they're some kind of a wimp if they're not very positive in, quote, fighting it hard enough.
Okay. So you mentioned the word stigma earlier, and both of us work with lung cancer patients, and oftentimes you have a lung cancer patient that would much rather tell you that they had breast cancer or prostate cancer or some other cancer than lung cancer. So what is the stigma, and what is the impact it has on the patient?
Well, I started doing a group of patients with lung cancer, with advanced lung cancer, 20 years ago. And at that time, there was a terrible stigma. And the reason I started the group was that a woman with lung cancer came to me and said, you know, would you believe I sit in the clinic and wish I had breast cancer? Because okay. They've got groups and they've got, you know, all kinds of support, and nobody supports lung cancer. So I said, you're right, let's do something about that. And we started the group. And I think it's the shame that in those days there was an enormous amount of sense that you brought it on yourself, that you mm-hmm. smoked and it's your own damn fault that you got cancer. And that, you know, added to the burden. I think that we've become more clear that many people get lung cancer who never smoked. And that number is increasing as time goes on. So there, I believe, and I still do my lung group, that they would say there's less stigma than there used to be, but it's still there. It's also, I think, a worse stigma with tumors that have a particularly bad outcome. For example, pancreatic cancer patients don't really want to tell the world they have pancreatic cancer because that carries a pretty dire prognosis in society's mind, too. So I think it's a sort of sense of not wanting to present something that's going to be looked upon by somebody else in a very negative way.
I've had the experience where patients describe a real sense of isolation. Mm-hmm. Is this something that you've been working
well,
on?
Well, I think that there's a feeling of sometimes like the rest of the world looks healthy and they're all doing fine and I'm all here by myself just trying, struggling, and I feel very alone with my disease. While they may have a good circle of family around them, they still feel alone in the sense of it's just me that has a disease and everybody else looks healthy and normal. So I think it's a kind of feeling that's inside that comes from having an illness that's serious and threatening to life.
So it sounds like that type of everyone else looks healthy is something that a support group helps patients.
I think it helps a lot. Helps a lot. And I think it, you know, you get over some of the, you find other people have the same feelings. Like, you know, I see people walk down the street, and I'm angry with them because they're healthy, and I'm envious because they're healthy. And nobody wants to admit to that. But you can do it in a group where everybody is dealing with this same big dragon.
Yeah. Now, I've heard you mention that a doctor who has the experience of going through a serious illness, okay, has a very different perspective on the patient experience after they've gone through something
no
like
question.
That.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that a bit?
Sure. I think that some medical schools, you know, will take the student and take off all their normal clothes, put them in a Johnny shirt, and with no identification except a band, and make mm-hmm. them be a patient for a day. And it makes an enormous difference mm-hmm. to be stripped of all your ID and yourself, put you in a different place. And the physicians I know who've had serious illness and about with death will say, you know, I never looked upon my treatment, my care of patients the same since the day I had that very serious illness. I think any of us who goes through something in which death is a possibility, maybe a bad car accident, where you just happen to live instead of die, those kind of experiences, I think, are often followed by gratitude for being alive, mm-hmm. but also perceiving people in stress in a different way. I think that's called growth these days.
Uh-huh. You noted in The Human Side of Cancer that your husband, a noted oncologist, okay, said that the one common organ involved in every cancer patient's situation is the mind.
Well, yes, it's an interesting idea that I think helped me sell psycho-oncology, okay. with the idea that every interaction that the patient has, whether it's in the clinic or in the hospital, no matter what treatment they get, no matter where they are in the world getting it, there is an interaction that's psychological, and the psychological and the social issues are right there. So he has said, what you do, what I do, is the only specialty in cancer that's involved in every interaction mm-hmm. with every patient at every visit. I thought that was fabulous. I use that sometimes to propose my how important psycho-oncology really is. It's come late to the scene. Again, you wonder why so late, but I think that the stigma attached to cancer was part of it, but then there's still a stigma attached to anything mental. Mm-hmm. Patients will say, mm-hmm. I don't want somebody to think I'm a wimp, Dr. Holland. If I come see you, somebody will think I'm crazy, so mm-hmm. I don't really want your help. Those kind of negatives are still there. People think that, what we did, we've come upon using the word distress. What's your distress level, 0 mm-hmm. to 10? Like we ask, how is your pain level, 0 to 10? Right. Well, anybody can be distressed. There's no stigma attached to being distressed, right? Mm-hmm. And you can be a little distressed or you can be a lot distressed. But we've used that question and asked the oncologist to ask it in the clinic with a routine visit. And if the patient says 4 or greater, well, I'm pretty distressed, I'm about at 6 today or mm-hmm. 7 or 8, then you say, well, I'd love to know why. Talk with my nurse now or talk with me a little bit more and tell me why you're upset. And then we know to refer them to social work, to mental health, or to the chaplaincy because, one's beliefs become very important as a kind of a support structure when we're very seriously worrying about the outcome of what our illness is going to be. Helplines have been terrific. We're trying to do more virtual groups, more online mm-hmm. kind of help. So the medium changes all the time. But I think all of them really are predicated on the fact that going through cancer is a difficult experience, can be very hard. And people can use some help, and they don't have to feel as if they're wimpish because they have right. to have it. Okay.
Right. Yeah. So okay. kind of summing it up, what inspires you to every day stay there in the trenches of working with cancer patients and their coping?
You're going to think I'm a little crazy, which might be right, but I say I'm still having fun. I love right. every day I spend at Memorial. It's exciting. I'm doing something meaningful to people, something meaningful that I know how to do to help mm-hmm. people at a particular time in their illness. Things are tough. They're not easy. And we see many sad, sad situations. Mm-hmm. But I also get all the rewards of helping people at those times mm-hmm. and of seeing many people do very well.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jimmy. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Thanks.